This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on this week's edition of Food Friday, we're traveling to the Mediterranean Basin. Join us for a conversation with the author of the new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish. First, food allergies have increased drastically in children in the last few decades. Check this out, 50% since the 1990s, according to the CDC. And research also indicates that food allergies are much more prevalent among adults than previously thought, including adult-onset food allergies. One study found that 11% of U.S. adults had a confirmed food allergy and 20% suspected they had a food allergy. Nearly half of the respondents said they'd acquired at least one food allergy in adulthood. So we're talking about why food allergies have become so much more prevalent in children and are fairly common in adults. And want to hear what you think as well at 1-800-642-1234. Do you or your children have food allergies? And what's the experience been like for you? Did you develop food allergies as an adult? Join us, 800-642-1234. And what are some of the terrors you've experienced as a parent? You can always email us ideas@wpr.org anytime. And our guest is Dr. Mark Moss, director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And Dr. Moss, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
And from your experience in your practice, just how much have allergies increased among kids in the last few decades?
There's definitely been an increase in food allergies, and I can personally describe how that's been seen in my practice. When I think back to when I was training a couple decades ago, there were relatively smaller numbers of children with food allergies, and that number has just steadily increased over time. Another practical way to think of it is for a lot of people that are now adults and may have children themselves, is when they think back to being in school and being school age, there weren't a lot of other children that they remember having food allergies. Maybe you know, the rare situation where someone maybe in their class or another class had a food allergy. And now it's not uncommon for at least one child or maybe even two or more to have a food allergy in any given elementary school class.
And do we know whether more babies are being born with food allergies or whether more infants are developing them after birth?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's important to remember that people in general are not born with allergies. So okay. When we're born, we may have a risk of developing allergy as we get older. But we aren't born with allergies, and that's for food allergy and for environmental allergies as well. But as we grow, as infants develop and get older, the chance of developing allergic diseases increases, and often that's initially seen with a skin condition called eczema or atopic dermatitis. Which is a dry, red, itchy skin condition that many infants have. But in children that are prone to have allergy can be much more prevalent. And then as children grow older, that's when they develop allergies at various ages throughout their lifetime.
So then what about adults, Dr. Moss? Have food allergies actually increased among adults, or do we just not know enough about food allergies in adulthood?
Another really good question. So we have to be a little careful in adults. Most of there really have not been a lot of extensive studies looking at food allergy in adults. And it's an area that is one that is ripe for further investigation. The challenge with a lot of studies that are done with adults is that they're done by phone or questionnaire. And so the question of whether someone has a food allergy is directed to the individual, the person. And they may or may not know whether they have an allergy, but they know that when they eat something, they may not feel good. And as a result, a lot of people will label that as being an allergy, when in fact it could be a host of other food-related conditions. And as a result, you sometimes get an overestimate in adults of the number of people that have a true food allergy.
Dr. Moss, is part of this increase in allergy, food allergies among children, an improvement in diagnoses?
Another good question. So, you know, diagnostics for food allergy have definitely advanced over the last few decades. In general, the ways that food allergies are diagnosed have been very good over time. So this is something that's likely not due to greater diagnosis or recognition as as in some conditions it can be, but rather there's something that is changing. And when we see a change that occurs this rapidly in time, it tends to be something that we have to think of as being environmental or something external to people that's driving this change.
Dr. Mark Moss, our guest, director of the clinical research program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, taking a look at the rise of food allergies among children and getting your reaction at 1-800-642-1234, where Dennis and Rivers is standing by. Dennis, good afternoon. You're on the air with Dr. Mark Moss.
Hi. I was surprised when I heard a bite from a Lone Star tick can cause an allergy to meat. I thought, well, allergy, I thought that would be something somebody would have genetically. So I just wonder, well, what other bites or exposures in the environment might make us susceptible to allergies? I'll hang up and listen.
Dennis, I appreciate that. I've heard the story, too, that there is this tick, the Lone Star tick, and it could cause a meat allergy. Dr. Moss?
Yeah, that's right. This is something that's definitely been recognized more recently. And what occurs is a susceptible individual, if they're bitten by the Lone Star tick, it'll elicit an immune response that then causes a person to generate something called IgE, which is an immune globulin that's important in allergy, directed against red meat. And typically this would be beef and pork. And then subsequently, when a person eats one of these foods, they may develop a reaction. And it's somewhat of an unusual food allergy. Usually food allergy is something that occurs very quickly, within minutes of eating the food. But with this Lone Star tick bite associated reaction, it's an IgE that reaction that's directed against some of the carbohydrates in the meat. And it's a much more delayed reaction. It occurs hours later. So often people will eat dinner, go to bed feeling fine, and then wake up 6 hours later with flushing and vomiting and feeling poorly. So that's a good example of an understanding of, again, a not typical food allergy, but definitely a reaction that's been appreciated in recent years.
And Dennis asks, are there other bites that or other insects, other external elements that could cause these allergies?
Yeah, so this is one of the best described situations. So we don't know. We don't know if there's other bites or insect interactions that might drive this. We do know that there are some relationships between another bug, if you will, which are called dust mites. Dust mites are a very common cause of allergy. They're microscopic members of the spider family that live in bedding. And they share a lot of similar allergens to shrimp and other shellfish. So that's an association between an insect or a bug and a food that we sometimes see and is being appreciated in a much better way, that people that have underlying allergy to dust mite, again, a fairly common allergy, may, as they get older, develop reactions when they eat shellfish such as shrimp.
What's the prevalence of Lone Star tick bites versus dust mite allergens in Wisconsin, Dr. Moss?
It's a night and day. So, okay. You know, very, very few people have Lone Star tick bites. Fortunately, they're not really indigenous to the area. They're more in southern areas. So we do see some people here, usually who've moved from the south and have moved from the east. It's a very, very rare condition. I've only seen it once or twice in my practice. But other places in the country, you see it more frequently. Dust mite allergy, on the other hand, is very frequent. It's actually one of the most common airborne allergens that people are allergic to and can affect as many as 40% of people that have allergic rhinitis or nasal allergies.
Yeah, would there be any connection to potentially from dust mites to food allergies?
So the only one that we really know well is this a similar homology between the allergens for dust mites and shrimp. And okay. And even that is it's a very small number of people. So most people that are allergic to dust mites have no trouble if they eat shellfish.
We're talking about food allergies and why they've been on the rise among children and adults in recent years. Our guest is Dr. Mark Moss, director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And join us, 800-642-1234. How did you expose your children to some of the common allergens like peanuts, eggs, and soy? And if you had a child with food allergies, how do you navigate school and other places where they might be exposed? What questions do you have for our allergist expert? Call us, 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. And right now, we're picking up our conversation about food allergies with Dr. Mark Moss. He directs the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Give out the number for you to join us at any time at 1-800-642-1234 with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. And Dr. Moss, the question I have for you are, what are some of the hypotheses for why we've seen these food allergies increase among children in such a short span of time? What are some of the scientific things that we're thinking of?
Yeah, so the best theory is something called the hygiene hypothesis, which involves the concept that over time, people have been exposed to different amounts of things in the environment, specifically bacteria and fungal products that we were exposed to much more frequently when we all grew up in more rural areas, on farms, not in big cities or suburbia. And over time, this has changed significantly with people moving to more urban areas. And as a result, people and children and young children are not exposed to these bacterial products. For example, on a farm, you have animals, large animals that have a lot of waste that carries bacteria. And while we think of this as, you know, being something you want to avoid, there may actually be something beneficial to the bacteria people are exposed to in these environments. And a couple of my colleagues here at the UW, I have a large group of infants and now young children that they follow, born on farms and in nearby cities or towns, trying to identify what is the, if you will, the ingredient, the magic or beneficial ingredient on the farm that helps to shift someone's immune system from becoming allergic to remaining non-allergic. And if we can figure that out, our hope is that with time, we may be able to introduce children or infants to these bacterial products at a very young age that may be beneficial in the prevention of development of allergies.
Let's go back to your questions now for our guest, Dr. Mark Moss, at 1-800-642-1234. We're Dee and McFarland standing by. Dee, you're on Central Time.
Hey there. Question for you about the possibility of food allergies being passed down through the family. Basically, in my family, we have a lot of seasonal allergies. And do those relate to food allergies?
And could you say a lot of what type of allergies?
You know, like seasonal, they used to call it hay fever.
Seasonal.
But
allergies.
Now I've got grandsons who have food allergies.
Sure. Your situation is actually one I see every day in clinic, where parents, grandparents may have had seasonal allergies, but now children or grandchildren are developing food allergies. And this gets at that concept that people, again, aren't born with food allergies, but they're born with this genetic predisposition to have allergy, something called atopy. And when they are born, they may or may not encounter some of these external factors that may shift them from being more likely to be allergic to rather than be less likely to be allergic. So that's one of the common situations we hear where the children that are born with food allergies, not born, but develop food allergies, are born to parents that have a history of allergy. And it may be as something as simple as hay fever.
Let's continue with your questions for our guest, Dr. Mark Moss. We'll go to Janet next, who's in Spring Green. Good afternoon, Janet.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What do you have for us?
My comment is that up until sometime in the 80s, we fed infants formula for the first 4 to 6 months. But when they were doing well, we would introduce cereal and fruits and some vegetables. And then at 6 months, we basically put them on solid foods. I know there are several countries in Africa where newborns are given honey and ground peanuts, and virtually there's no peanut allergies in those countries. Do you think that the trend towards formula for the first year has brought about some of these problems?
A number of different aspects there, Janet. Thank you. Dr. Moss?
Yeah, you've got a lot of important questions embedded in your question. And we know that breastfeeding is very good for infants and encourage it greatly. And there do seem to be benefits in breast milk. We do see a variety of different, obviously beneficial substances, and see food that the mother eats can be transmitted in breast milk, or the proteins of these allergens of these foods can be transmitted. So there can be some benefits to breastfeeding. But the other question, or the other part of the question, had to do with some of the early introduction of solid foods. And this is a newer concept that we are now seeing, where about 5-6 years ago, there was a study done in Great Britain that looked at children, and why there were more children in Great Britain who had food allergy to peanut versus other parts of the country like Israel, where children with food allergy are fairly low in number. And the big difference was that in Israel, kids were fed peanut in the form of these puffs with peanut protein very early in life, before a year of age. Subsequent studies showed that introduction of peanut in the right children, so children, again, who are at risk of developing allergy, not just the average person that's never going to develop allergies no matter what you do, but the children at risk for developing allergy, if they're given peanut early on, that you can potentially shift their immune system from becoming allergic to peanut to not being allergic to peanut. And this is a study, it's called the LEAP study, and it was really revolutionary in our understanding of some of the parts of the development of food allergy to peanut. Now, a lot of people would try to extrapolate that to other foods, and we're not quite there yet. But a couple of my colleagues, Dr. Anne-Marie Singh, Dr. Jim Gern here at the university, have two birth cohort studies that are recruiting mothers who are pregnant to enroll their infants in these two studies, looking at really what puts kids at risk of developing allergy in the first place. And that's going to really expand our understanding of what risk factors may be present very, very early on in life, and hopefully answer some of the questions in your multifaceted question.
Let's continue with your questions now. We'll go to Dan in Lone Rock next. Dan, you're on the air with Dr. Mark Moss, Director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at UW Health.
Yeah, hey, I kind of a couple of questions in one, I've heard especially with grain allergies, people explain it in relation to the, you know, increased herbicides and pesticides that are on our crops and then therefore kind of in our food. But my brain also jumps to the we've got a lot more synthetic additives and packaging. And I'm just wondering what you're finding out about those relationships and causation for food allergies.
Yeah, Dan, thank you. Pesticides, herbicides, packaging, wrapping, all the plastics. Dr. Moss?
Yeah, so a lot of that we don't have a great understanding about, but certainly a lot of those factors change some of the makeup of bacterial products in foods. And that may be part of what may be driving some of this. Again, the old saying that a little bit of dirt early on or a little bit of bacteria early on is probably beneficial for you. That's, again, a very big change that we've seen environmentally in the way we live in the last few years. So more to probably come on that as we are able to delve deeper into some of these early onset causes of allergy in general.
Dr. Moss, are there certain populations that are more susceptible to this trend of increased food allergies among children, socioeconomic, race? Is there a breakdown that you can find?
Yeah, one of the biggest factors that seems to make a difference is again, we talked about genetics with the earlier caller's question. And so people that are genetically at risk, so having family members that are allergic puts individuals at a greater chance to develop allergy themselves. And then early development of eczema or atopic dermatitis, where the skin is somewhat susceptible, may be one of the causes or one of the associations that seems to put children at risk. So there's a lot of factors that go into this, which again is why it's important to try to look at children from an early age before they have allergy. And then to help determine what is going on with their own bacteria, their microbiome in their stool, their secretions in their nose, the integrity of their skin. And all of these are things that are being looked at in a couple of the studies I mentioned earlier.
Dr. Moss, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the program.
You bet. Dr. Moss, Director of the Clinical Research Program in the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday, and we take you to the Mediterranean with the author of the new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Happy Friday. It's Central Time, and I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with Florida's Secretary of State about how it was his state was able to have votes all counted up on election night. And then Wisconsin's former longtime chief election official contrasts that with how things work in our dairy state. But now it's Food Friday, and this week we are taking you to the Mediterranean. Our next guest has been eating and cooking Mediterranean food her whole life, and she shares it with us today, some of her favorite dishes that she wants you to try. And you can join our conversation with your questions. If you've got a favorite Mediterranean dish, share it with us this afternoon. Have you tried following the Mediterranean diet? What questions do you have about Mediterranean cooking, spices, and what you might want to have on hand? Call us 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can always email us ideas@WPR.org. Susie Carace is the founder of themediterraneandish.com, a Mediterranean food and lifestyle site, and she's with us today to talk about her new cookbook, New York Times bestseller, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And Susie, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, I really enjoyed your story, and I'd love for you to share a little bit with us this afternoon. You grew up in Egypt, and can you talk about some of your experiences with food growing up there?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up right on the shores of the Mediterranean in Egypt in a cosmopolitan Mediterranean city called Port Said, which is the north entrance to the Suez Canal. And there I was lucky enough to be exposed to all sorts of flavors from all over the Mediterranean. A port city, the way you live in a port city is really just kind of all about the foods that nature has given us. We ate a lot of seafood. And I remember going with my father to the market multiple times a week, just checking out the fresh produce and all the sunny flavors. And naturally, countries of the Mediterranean, or at least for sure port cities, they share a lot of excitement around food. And so we ate a lot of Greek-influenced flavors, Italian, Turkish, North African. I had it all, and it wasn't really with a ton of thought around where this came from, but it was just like a ton of enjoyable food. And so I grew up with all that. My mom was a great cook. My dad made sure I understood how to select the best produce and all of that good stuff. So yes, I'm so fortunate.
Yeah, that's part of the story. And then there's the part where you come to Canada and you end up in Michigan and you learn that sharing this food with everybody else becomes a connector, which is universal.
Yes, absolutely. And to be honest, and I feel like most people would probably resonate with this, the idea of getting around, sitting around the table and sharing a meal together, there's really nothing like it. And if you wanted to get to know somebody, you sat at the table. And that's how I grew up. My parents were very big into hospitality, as with many parts of the Mediterranean and the Middle East. And we've had a lot of friends and strangers at our table. And so naturally for me, I would just invite people to try my food. And I made a lot of friends doing that.
Susie Carace is the founder of themediterraneandish.com. And she has a New York Times bestseller, the new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you can join the conversation at any time at 1-800-642-1234. And Susie, okay, what are a few pantry essentials that we'd want to have on hand if we were to start doing some Mediterranean cooking? What do we have to have?
You know, that's such a great question, because a lot of people may not think that they have a lot of the ingredients to make Mediterranean food already in their pantries. So, for example, for me, the all essential extra virgin olive oil is a big deal in eating the Mediterranean way, but also some of the very simple, very humble ingredients in your pantry, such as canned beans or grains, or even, you know, dried beans as well is another one. And obviously lots of veggies and fruits in your fridge. And I guess I'm lumping in the fridge section as well.
Sure.
The flavor makers for me have got to be a lot of garlic,
yep,
a lot of citrus, and a lot of fresh produce, and especially herbs. I think if people were to just kind of like sift through some of the things they have in their pantry and in their fridge, you'd be surprised how easily it is to cook a Mediterranean meal with what you have on hand.
All right, Susie. And our recipes that our guest is sharing with us today can be found anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. So keep that in mind, because I've told people we're going to tell them about the smoothest, fluffiest hummus today, Susie. And you have that as one of your recipes in your new cookbook. So what is that? I mean, I think most people get the gist. There's some extra virgin olive oil. You've got some chickpeas. You've got some tahini. Got some citrus in there. But what is it that makes it? And you can find the full recipe on the website or in Susie's cookbook. What is it that makes it the smoothest and fluffiest? What do you do different?
Yes, I'm going to share this credit because I learned it from my mother-in-law, Mama Dina, who is really a master of the Middle Eastern kitchen. She grew up in Jordan and actually ran a couple of restaurants in Michigan for a while. And I learned from her a couple of major tips when you're making homemade hummus. First of all, making sure that you peel the chickpeas. It does actually make a difference. I get lazy sometimes and I don't always do it, but when I do it and I take a minute to just take care of that, of those peeling the chickpeas, it does make a difference in the final texture, and it's extra smooth. But as you are making the hummus in the food processor, one thing that I've learned from her or watching her do it, she drops a couple of ice cubes from the top of the food processor as the hummus is processing. And this really just gives it that fluffy, whipped, really light texture, as if you were making ice cream. And it is the funnest thing to try. So definitely those two tips. And even if you end up using canned chickpeas, which I do, I mean, because dry chickpeas will require you to soak them overnight and then you're going to cook them and whatever. But if you end up using canned chickpeas, which are a fine option here, I also do end up cooking them for a little bit, 15, 20 minutes or so. That will actually allow them to be extra tender, which is also another trick for, I guess, kind of faking it into making hummus from scratch, but without really using dried beans and taking the time to soak them. So those are the three tips, and that's how I make it today.
Homemade pita or store-bought pita?
Well, unless you have an amazing Middle Eastern bakery by you, you're probably not going to have the freshest pita. The pita I grew up with at home in Egypt, we actually bought every single day. And my father was adamant about this. He would just only buy 5 pitas per day. And it was like one of these things where it's like, no, we have to have it fresh. So every morning someone had the chore of getting the fresh pita, and it was puffy and pillowy and absolutely delicious. And it's also part of the culture of like not wasting. That was a big deal too growing up. But here in the States, it's kind of hard to find really good fluffy fresh pita unless you do live near a Middle Eastern bakery. So you can easily make it at home, and it's not hard. It's a very basic recipe. It's in the book, and I do make it often, and sometimes I'll make a larger batch and freeze it, and it freezes very well.
The recipe that I made last night from your cookbook, Susie Karacha, is the harissa red lentil and tomato soup. It was easy, it was affordable, and it was delicious. And as you, our technical director, Sarah Hopeful, is dining on it right now with a little bit of crusty bread on the side. It's just perfect. But what is it about these spices that all go together to create that full flavor?
Yes. Yeah, so... Well, so obviously lentils, they're kind of almost neutral flavored, right? So you want to, but they're so filling and satisfying and have, they will give you some good nutrition. So in this particular recipe, I rely on harissa paste, a North African condiment, so to speak, that kind of just gives it that extra zing, a little bit more spice, and it just finishes it so well that everything comes together. It's so coherent. Another thing that I love to add to a lot of my soups, and in this one as well, I think like a little bit of citrus will round out the flavor too.
That lime, and then you add the cilantro on top, and it gives it a fresh pop right above the kick of the spice of the harissa. That is something that we will be enjoying throughout this entire chili weekend. It's a nice hearty meal.
Yes, absolutely. And also, like you said, super affordable. And a lot of people are looking at the cost, a rising cost of food these days. And again, another plug for lentils and legumes in general. They are pretty affordable and very satisfying. And the way that we eat, Mediterranean way of eating, is very humble food for the most part, and not super expensive.
It's Food Friday, and we're breaking bread with Susie Karacha with her new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you can find those recipes that we're sharing with you this afternoon online anytime at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you have a question for our guest chef today, 1-800-642-1234. If you have a Mediterranean dish that you'd like to share, 1-800-642-1234. We have more for you when we continue here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and we're picking up our talk with Susie Karacha about her new cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you will make on repeat. And if you've got a question or if you've got a dish you'd like to share, Food Friday, it's time to do it. 1-800-642-1234. And Susie, let's move on to your next dish. This one I am dying to try, and you have to explain it a little bit for us. Cheater's Hawashi Pitas. What are these?
Okay, well, Hawashi is a very Egyptian meal. It's also one of those street foods that I grew up with. And if you were to make it the proper way, not the cheater's way, you would make a dough from scratch, and you would fill it with this beautiful meat mixture, ground beef mixture, that is filled with spices, a little bit of hot pepper, and all that jazz. You make it into a patty, and you kind of encase it with this dough, and it's usually cooked in like a domed clay oven super quick, and it comes out hot, and you are typically standing in a long line of people waiting for this little pie of hawashi. But at home, when I make it, I kind of stick true to the flavors, the big flavors in it, the bold spices and a little bit of the hot peppers. I actually just use jalapenos here in the state. And I replace the whole making of the dough with just already made pita bread. So I'll cut the pita in half, and I will stick this beautiful meat mixture uncooked into the pita, and you stick it in the oven. And it's a great way to honestly feed a crowd of people on a budget, because you'll stretch about a pound and a half of ground beef to make a good number of hawashi sandwiches. And it takes about 15 minutes or so in the oven. And it is just as exciting for me. And hey, nobody's ever mad about a shortcut. So that's my cheat. Hawashi.
And how about these seasonings? As the recipe details, and again, you can find it at your leisure at WPR.org/Food Friday. Allspice, black pepper, coriander, sweet paprika, ground cardamom, some cumin in there, and some cinnamon too.
Yes.
What's
all
that?
The things, basically.
Oh, yeah, it's a little bit of everything. But what
does a lot of warm flavors, kind of leans quite North African, if you really look at it. And, you know, and the recipes do vary from one place to another, but this is kind of the recipe that I learned at home, and I have always made it this way, and everyone loves it, but it is pretty bold. When people ask me what is hawashi, I have found myself resorting to this lazy answer of like, well, you know, it's Egypt's way to a hamburger. It's really not, because a hamburger is really well known in Egypt too, as we know it here, just the simple patty on a bun. But this one is a little bit on steroids, I would say. With all the
Susie Karace is the author of the cookbook, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you write about the idea of nafas in Mediterranean cooking. Susie, yes. Can you share that with us?
Yes. The word nafas in Arabic means breath. It also means soul. And if you were to talk about food and creating food and feeding the people around you, and let's say you're in a conversation with one of the tetas, the grandmas in Egypt, and you're wanting a recipe from her, you will never get a precise recipe from anyone, really, but particularly the older generation. And they'll be like, you know, a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and then a whole lot of nefes, meaning just the whole spirit behind creating the food is what really makes it special and delicious. So the idea would be you're breathing into it a lot of love, and you're using a lot of your own God-given intuition. And don't worry so much about the measurement, as long as you're cooking from within, so to speak, with all your soul, and you're excited about generously sharing. The food that you're creating is laced with deliciousness. So I grew up with that idea, and it gives me such joy. And really kind of when I talk about cooking the Mediterranean way or the Egyptian way even, it gives me a lot of like peace in knowing that, hey, you know, if I mess up, at least I tried. I tried my best, and I was having fun doing it, and I'm feeding the people I love. And so it's not a whole lot of following the rules. I grew up more of like, you know, just kind of, you're going to learn how to put these flavors together the more you do it, and just kind of go at it with all your heart and give it all your attention, and it will turn out okay.
So when Susie Karace says a tablespoon of this, a teaspoon of that, a quarter tablespoon of the other thing, what you really...
I'm better now. Well, so the thing is, I started religiously measuring now that I cook for a living and other people are following my recipes. So not to worry, every recipe in the book and on the site has been tested to perfection and has been measured a million times, because there are people counting on it.
Absolutely. And so let's move on to the last recipe that we're sharing with our audience from your book today, and that is the charred honeyed apricots with pistachios. This sounds delectable. Is this a dessert?
You know what? I can't honestly even call it a dessert nor a recipe. I cheated my way into it and put it in the book anyway. But it's one of those things that it's like, you know, you've got some good ripe apricots or any stone fruit of your choice. Peaches will work well with this recipe. Mm. And if your sweet tooth is calling for something and you don't have the time to bake, like me, I'm not a huge baker. This is a great recipe to do that. And just a very simple and exciting, yes, let's call it dessert for the sake of being clear here, it is a sweeter option. So I just simply kind of toss it with a little bit of citrus and a little bit of sugar, I think brown sugar, and then you stick it under the broiler for, oh, maybe 5 to 7 minutes, and it kind of bubbles up and gets charred beautifully, and you finish it up with some honey and maybe a little bit of pistachio to just kind of looks a little more fancy than it really is. And it's such a simple, simple, delicious dessert.
Yeah, it's just a handful of ingredients, and it's just a few minutes to throw it all together. And when you're done, I have yet to try this, but it is certainly part of my list now. And again, you can find the full recipe in full detail online at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you talk about Mediterranean baking, Susie, how would you compare it or make it different from American baking?
Oh, yeah, well, that's a great question. So for me, when I think about the way people bake in that part of the world where I grew up, the baked goods are not too sweet. For the most part, they're just right. So, and also, we don't always have a ton of frosting on anything. Like a cake as simple as an olive oil cake without a whole lot on it, but a sprinkle of maybe shaved citrus like oranges and a little bit of powdered sugar is just as exciting to people as something that is layered with, you know, all the frosting. So I feel like we have a variety of things that take just a handful of ingredients and they turn out amazing. I will say my favorite dessert will always and forever be, baklava. And that's the one that I will probably be making during the holiday season. And it's in the book as well. We call it a triple nutty baklava.
Okay. How hard is that? Because from my experience, I cannot make baklava. I'll just say that.
Okay, well, it's actually a lot easier than most people think, because if you envision, have you ever made a lasagna?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so if you envision sort of a layering situation, like a casserole, and you're layering, you know, I don't know, the pasta, the meat, the whatever, to make a lasagna, think of it in the same terms. You're layering some phyllo cheese, a little bit of nuts with some sugar and cinnamon, and then some more phyllo, and you're kind of just, it's very therapeutic, actually. You're just assembling something in a baking dish. And the biggest thing for me with baklava, and I really have become a sort of a baklava snob, unnecessarily, I suppose, unintentionally, just because of I've eaten it at home more than I have outside. The biggest thing for me is to make sure that as soon as you take the baklava out of the oven, you hit it up with the honey syrup, which allows the cooler honey syrup to be absorbed really well in the layers of flaky hot phyllo dough. Phyllo pastry is very thin to work with, and so a lot of people fear working with it, but if it breaks, nobody cares. So I really highly encourage you to try the recipe in the book. It's very easy.
I will have to give it a try, and I will have to let you know. Susie Karache, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome. Glad to be here. Thank you.
You bet. And again, all those recipes that we talked about this afternoon are from Susie Karache's new cookbook, New York Times bestseller, The Mediterranean Dish, 120 bold and healthy recipes you'll make on repeat. And you can find all these recipes we talked about and a link to the cookbook at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, coming up Monday on the morning show, it is your state capitol report. And Kate Archer-Kent brings you the results of school referenda from across the state with State Superintendent Jill Underley. Also, an investigation into all the ballots that were all the races that were uncontested in Wisconsin on Tuesday and what that means for our democracy. Kate also has cocktails waiting for you on Monday morning, exploring the mixed drinks that have become classics. Find out more Monday morning from 7 to 9 on the Ideas Network. So today is Veterans Day, and here's to all who have served and their families who have all served beside them. My old man never talked much about Vietnam, but he is speaking to his granddaughter's classroom this afternoon about some of his experiences. I learned about his tour of duty from a book about the 1967 Lakeland College Muskies Championship football team, where my father played a mean linebacker. Quoting from a Muskie memoir by Vin Mannix, this is how my dad remembers graduating from Lakeland College in Sheboygan in 1969. I handed my mother my diploma, and she handed me my draft notice. He drew number 13 in the first draft lottery and would go on to fight in the Army's 4th Infantry Division in Vietnam. Your goal was always to come home alive, he told the author, and Dad did. But his freshman year roommate did not. Bob Hurry left Lakeland College, enlisted in the Army, became a Green Beret, and was killed in combat at the age of 22. And I had no idea. To all of those who have served and their families who have all served beside them, thank you.